God, thank you for this day. Thank you for the warm weather. And I pray that we would just be able to learn so much from you today, whatever you have for us. And pray that we'd be able to finish residency strong and get through everything, and that the final would go well for everyone, and that Israel would be great. You know.
Amen. All right.
Great.
All right. So we've come off kind of Camelot, right? So we've been in the great season of David. We are now obviously on the downhill slide off of Camelot with David and Bathsheba, chapter 11. We saw the rebuke from Nathan and the great story that he came to David with, but the travelers and sin and all these aspects confronts David. David confesses. We're seeing now that there are consequences. David's son that he has with Bathsheba dies. David begs God for that not to happen. When it does, he moves on. He is not just moves on, but obviously he trusts God and he's moved on. And now he's going to have another son with Bathsheba, Solomon, obviously, who will be the next king. Speaking of, did everybody get that chart that I kind of handed out the other day? The king's chart, all the pretty colors. Okay, so you don't need those yet, but we're at the very top of that chart. So you can see the united monarchy. Okay, so we're in that season right now. Saul, David, Solomon are the three kings of the united monarchy, all led for 40 years. And then we'll get into the split that happens underneath Solomon, and I'll remind you of some of those key dates. You need to memorize every king on there, every detail about their lives, and they're going to be in like detail on the test, okay? That's a joke, okay? There's a couple things that you're going to need to know about a few of them, all right? A couple key dates that hopefully you guys already are hearing, all right? But just to give you kind of the grand scope of Samuel and the kings, that's that chart, okay? Today, we're going to look at a rough story, okay? So just to prepare you guys for it, 13's rough, okay? And there's some great that's going to come out of it, but 13's rough, okay? So 13 verse 1, let's pick up there, and let's kind of see what's going on within David's kingdom.
Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, loved her.
All right, so we've got, welcome to David's world. We have now multiple wives, right? So now you get multiple kids from multiple wives. We got half-brothers and that whole thing going on. So you've got Absalom, who's a full-blood relative to his sister Tamar, okay? So same mom and dad. Then you've got Amnon, who is a half-brother, okay? Has a different mom than Tamar, okay? Who falls in love with his half-sister, okay? I say falls in love. He thinks he's in love with her. He is in lust with her, okay? So you've got this very odd situation that is now one of the results of having many wives in your kingdom. Amnon, verse 2, was so frustrated because of his sister that he made himself ill. Literally, he is sexually frustrated, for she was a virgin, and it seemed hard to Amnon to do anything to her, okay? You can see where this text is going, okay? So he is not a godly guy. He is got his eyes on his half-sister. This story's going to end poorly, okay? And he's got a friend that is one of the worst type of friends you can have. Verse 3, read that.
Amnon had a friend whose name was
Jonadab.
Jonabad, his son of Shemaiah, David's brother. And Jonabad was a very crafty man. And he said to him, O son of the king, why are you so haggard morning after morning? Will you not tell me? Amnon said to him, I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister. Jonabad said to him, lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill, and when your father comes to see you, say to him, let my sister Tamar come and give me bread to eat, and prepare the food in my sight, that I may see it and eat from her hand.
All right, so you've got Tamar, who's the sister, right? You've got Amnon, the brother, the half-brother. He says to his buddy Jonadab, I'm in love with her. It's like, really? Like, I'm not sure that you are, buddy. I think you've just got... He's just a messed up guy. He tells this to his buddy Jonadab, and Jonadab says, great, let's set up a situation to where you can be basically alone with her and have your way with her. Okay, so bad situation. Fake to be ill. When David asks you, when your dad asks you what's wrong, say, man, I'm sick. I need to be fed and doted upon by Tamar, of course. Okay, so that's the situation. Amnon says, man, that sounds like a great idea, because then I'm going to get what I want. I don't really care what she wants, but I'm going to get what I want. He lays down, pretended to be ill. He says, hey, I really need Tamar to come serve me. David was like, Okay, so he knows nothing of what's going on in his brain. He says, great, send to Tamar, have her do that. They are now together. They are around a bunch of people in a room. Verse 9, she took the pan and dished out food before him, but he refused to eat. And Amnon said, have everyone go out from me. So everyone went out from him. So now he's getting in a room with her alone, okay, refusing to eat and saying, I need now time alone with you. Verse 10, he says, bring me the food into the bedroom that I may eat from your hand. Tamar took the cakes which had been made and brought them to him in the bedroom of her brother. And he says now in verse 11, come, lie with me, my sister. Okay, so that means exactly what you think it means. So come, have sex with me. Verse 12, this is her answer.
No, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel.
So what is her opinion on this matter? She clearly says, no, I'm not interested. And not only that, but she raises the bar to say, listen, this is not okay biblically. This is not okay with God. This is not okay in Israel. I am not willing, and this is not okay. So she very clearly states her case, okay? As for me, where could I go to get rid of my reproach? She walks through scripturally why this is a bad thing. And she does something that seems a little odd in verse 13, but ladies, I think you'll know exactly what she's doing. She says, now therefore, end of verse 13, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you. What is she saying? Maybe. Think about the situation that she's in. What is she trying to do?
Get an excuse for him to leave.
Exactly. She's trying to get out. So she's saying, she's seeing how forceful he's being. He's come on to her. She's like, whoa, like, I was here feeding you food. Now all of a sudden you want to have sex with me. And I think he's probably ramping up the violence that's about to come. And she's finding any way out of the situation. Hey, go ask Dad. He won't withhold you from me. Anything to get out of this present situation. Okay, so I don't think that means, hey, if Dad says it's okay, we can get married. It's a, I want the heck out of here like yesterday. Okay. Verse 14, however, he would not listen to her since he was stronger than she. He violated her and lay with her. Okay, I think some versions actually use the word rape, and that's exactly what happens here. Okay, so Amnon, the half-brother of Tamar, rapes Tamar. Okay, Amnon hated her with a very great hatred. Now, wait a second. I just thought he was in love with her a couple verses before, right? So what just happened within him? He violates her, he rapes her, and now he says, end of verse 15, get up, go away. He's feeling a sense of shame and guilt, so he wants her gone. He wants all memory of this incident gone, okay? So he's a wicked guy, okay? He sends her away, and she basically says, no, this is going to get brought to your attention. She goes basically into mourning. She puts on a long sleeve garment, hangs out with her virgin daughters, her friends, in verse 18. She walks around, verse 19, with ashes on her head, tore her long sleeve garment, which was on her. She goes into like the mourning as if somebody had died. This is like funeral attire in which you would do after a relative died. Okay. Her full blood brother Absalom realizes no one's dead. What happened? And he puts two and two together. And says in verse 20, has Amnon your brother been with you? He catches on and realizes something happened. I know you weren't willing. He puts two and two together and realizes you were raped by my half brother. Now, what do you think? What kind of tension is that going to create in the home? My half brother raped my full blood sister. Okay. So you can imagine Absalom is at like red line and is hot, angry, and rightly so. Okay. He says to her in verse 20, keep silent, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this matter to heart. So Tamar remained and was desolate in her brother Absalom's house. Now, if you're Absalom, why would you tell your sister to be quiet? Because what? He's going to go deal with it. Or better yet, who would deal with it? Dad. Okay? David would deal with it. Now, I think part of it is, hey, let's not make a mockery of our house, right? This is royalty. Okay? He wants it dealt with. So he's not saying Amnon gets a get out of jail free card. We're clearly going to see that in a little bit. Okay. He wants it dealt with, but he wants Dad to deal with it, which is the right thing to do. Okay. Now, whether or not that's the right plan or not, this obviously needs to be dealt with. This is wrong. This is sin. This is clearly what this chapter is about. Notice David's reaction in verse 21. So, David hears about it. So he knows exactly what's happened, correct? And how does he respond? In anger. Is that the right response? Absolutely. He should be furious at what happens. Okay? Keep going. Okay, again, normal response, okay? He's angry, he's bitter, I get that. Now, here's the problem, verse 23, Jane, keep going.
2 years later, when Absalom's...
Wait, how much longer later? 2 years. What's happened in between, David was very angry in 21, and 23, now it's 2 years later. Nothing. So, sister, be quiet. Dad's going to find out about the matter. He will deal with it. He's a righteous man. He's king of the land. He will take care of Amnon. It's 2 years later. What's David done? Nothing. What's David planning on doing? Nothing. Like, wait, we've got a problem now, right? We've got an issue where David, for whatever reason, will not execute justice on those that are closest to him. Have we seen this pattern in David's life? Who have we seen it with? Joab, right? We've seen the brothers of Zeruiah, like Joab, Abishai, when they go crazy and get bloodlust and start chopping people up or flying off the handle, David does not do what is right because he feels there's something there where he feels a check in his spirit. Now, we're going to get down to maybe why this is happening with David here in a minute, okay? And Joab is actually the guy that's going to realize there's something going on underneath the surface as to why David's not responding to this, okay? David's done nothing. Now, if you're Absalom, what's the problem with that? Is that acceptable? No, let's just sweep it under the rug. Let's pretend it didn't happen. Absalom says, absolutely not. Tamar, absolutely not, okay? Tamar can't necessarily avenge herself because she's a woman and she's weaker. So Absalom, as the full-blood brother, obviously would say, then that's my job. If dad's not going to do it, then I'm going to do it, okay? Now, the problem is Absalom is young and strong, and he's like a baby rattlesnake. Has no control over how much venom he's going to unleash. Do you guys know that the smallest snakes are the ones that are the most dangerous? Because they can't dose their venom. They give you 100% every time they bite. An adult will bite and give as much venom as they need to kill that prey and then release the prey, okay? Absalom doesn't have the maturity to understand how to correctly handle the situation, okay? So 2 years go by. He has a plan, okay? Amnon is away shearing his sheep. Okay, off in a distant land or up north in Israel. Absalom says to David, behold now, verse 24, your servant is with the sheep shears. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant. So why don't you send me with Amnon to shear the sheep? Okay, David is smart enough to say, I don't know. Pete 25, read that.
But the king said to Absalom, no, my son, let us not all go. Lest we be burdensome to you. He pressed him, but he would not go, but gave him his blessing.
So why would David say, I don't know that I want you guys to, you two alone in the wilderness? Right. Yeah, David gets it. He realizes, like, I've done nothing. You're hot, angry, mad. Amnon's just hoping all this is going to go away. So David, he feels a sense of, there's something I should have done that I didn't do. You guys with me? David understands that. It's not like he's like, I wonder what I should do, right? He gets it. He knows, and he realizes Absalom's got fire in his eyes, in his belly, if you will, okay? Absalom said, no, I want to go, okay? So David sends him, and he says, okay, go with your brother and go shear sheep. Verse 28, here's the plan. See now, when Absalom's heart is merry with wine, I will say to you, strike Amnon and put him to death. Do not fear. Have I not commanded you to do so? Be courageous and be valiant. So he tells his men, we're going to have a party tonight. We're going to get him hammered. And once his heart is merry with wine, kill him. And he says, don't worry about it. I told you to do it. It's all going to be good. And that's exactly what goes down. He gets hammered. The servant of Absalom killed Amnon. Let's see, verse 29, we kind of get the bit of the story. The king's son arose and fled. David is back at home, and there's a report that comes back to him, and he gets a wrong report initially. It says, Absalom has struck down all the king's sons and did not let one of them live. So David hears, not just Amnon died, but every one of my sons were killed at the hand of Absalom. Okay? The king arose, tore his clothes, gets word later on. No, 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 it's not everybody. It's just Amnon, verse 20 or 32. Amnon alone is dead because of the intent of Absalom that has been determined since this day that he violated his sister Tamar. So even the servants who tell David, like, buddy, you know why this happened. This is why it happened. Amnon was the only guy in Absalom's crosshairs, and now he's dead. Okay? Verse 33, only Amnon is dead. Absalom fled. So now what do you get? What do you have between David and Absalom? What has Absalom just committed? Murder. So what does David now? What should David do? Now he's in a really weird spot. He has put Absalom in this place to commit murder, which is not necessarily what God wanted, not at that hand, right? What's the what is the penalty, by the way, in Israel for rape?
Death.
Okay? Now, not like this, per se, but death. Absalom has now committed murder, so he's executed justice in some sense rightly, but this is vigilante justice, and that's not exactly what I think God had intended. So David has kind of forced Absalom's hand. He realizes that. So I didn't punish Amnon to begin with. I certainly can't punish Absalom because I didn't. So who's the problem here? David is the issue, okay? And he realizes that. So he's stuck and he doesn't know how to handle this because of his lack of ability to do anything. He's a bit in a jam. And again, we will discern why David is where he is in a minute, okay? So he finds this out. Verse 37, pick up there.
Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, son of Geshur. And David mourned for his son day after day.
Okay, so he misses Absalom. He mourns both Amnon's death and for Absalom's absence. Absalom fled, went to Geshur, was there 3 years. Okay, so he's left the kingdom, out in the middle of nowhere. What's Absalom hoping would happen, by the way, in this 3 year period? Nothing would be good. What would be better than nothing? He is estranged from his dad for 3 years for doing, in a sense, the right thing. But he knows he's committed murder. As a son, what do you want from your dad? Think about it.
Forgiveness.
You want him to say, I screwed up. I should have handled that. I forced your hand. I forgive you. Come home. Right? That's ultimately what he wants. Okay? Pete, you have a thought?
Is Geshur one of those safe cities?
Where is Geshur? No. It is not a city of refuge. I don't think so. Dang it. Now I'm blanking on it. Hebron. I don't think Geshur's one of them. But let me look. I'll double check that. Good question. The heart of David, verse 39, look at this, longed to go out to Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead. What does that mean? That's kind of weird.
He's over Amnon, so now he's focused
on Absalom. Kinda. I don't think he's over Amnon. He's still grieving for his son, but what does David realize happened in that?
He lost two sons.
In a sense, okay, he's certainly not too comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead. Why is he comforted? The issue's been resolved. It was dealt with the way it should have been dealt with to begin with. So he realizes, dang it, I should have done that, but in a sense, this is the right action. This is what should have occurred. So he's comforted in that Amnon got what Amnon deserved for violating his half-sister. It happened to be at Absalom's hand. So now he's stuck. That's the right thing, but the wrong way to do it, okay? See also chapter 14. Okay, this is brilliant. You want to talk about a woman who needs to be here in our Bible that never gets taught about? This gal, we don't have a name for her. She is brilliant. Okay, ladies, needs to be one of your heroes. Okay, she is a gal that completely changes the course of David's life, and we don't even know her name. And David's leadership would never be the same without this gal. Okay, 14:1, pick up there.
Now Joab, the son of
Zeruiah,
knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom. And Joab sent for Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her,
Okay, hold on real quick. So that's all we know about this gal. She's a wise woman. Joab knows her. She's from Tekoa, so I think east side. Joab realizes something. This is the part about Joab that I'm always so conflicted with. Every year I think like the story's going to end differently, and it ends the same with Joab every year. It's really weird. I want to like him, but I want to not like him. This is one of those chapters you go, man, I actually really like you. He recognizes David needs to get reconciled with his son, and he's not going to do it. I'm going to step in and make it happen. Okay, and that's what 14 is about. Joab is the mastermind behind this whole thing. He is the puppeteer, okay? And he's holding the marionette, which is the woman in a sense, on his strings. He's setting the stage for the actors to kind of know to go about their business, if you will. David doesn't realize he's in a play. Joab does, and this woman realizes, I'm in a play. I'm going to have you act a part, okay? He says to her, please pretend, in verse 2, to be a mourner and put on mourning garments and do not anoint yourself with oil, but be like a woman who has been mourning for the dead many days, okay? So look like you've been at a funeral for months, okay? Look awful. Go to the king and speak to him in this matter, in this manner, okay? Here's what I want you to say. She goes to the king, verse 4, goes to David, so they are face to face, and she says, help, O king. The king said in verse 5, what is your trouble? And she answered, truly, I am a widow, for my husband is dead. Okay? Now, I want you guys to recognize just the details of the situation and why Joab is doing what he's doing. Your maidservant had two sons, but the two of them struggled together in a field, and there was no one to separate them. In verse 6, so one struck the other and killed him. Behold, the whole family has risen against your maidservant, me, and says, hand over the one who has struck the brother that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed, and destroy the heir also. They will extinguish my coal which is left, so as to leave my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. Okay, here's the situation. She says to David, two sons, they were in a field. They were got in an argument and started battling. Nobody was there to fix the situation. One son killed the other son. I am a widow. My only heritage now is left in this other son. My family all wants this guy to get handed over and be killed. What do I do? If he dies and I allow what the law says is okay to do for this guy to die, then I'm going to lose my father's or my husband's legacy. It's all for naught. And she's basically asking the king, is that what God desires? Does he want the son, my son, to die for committing a crime when the consequences of enacting what is biblically okay is that God's heart, okay? Do you see what she's doing? David, you had two sons. One son killed the other son in even a more righteous way in the sense that he was executing justice. Now, what should happen to Absalom as a result of that? He should be brought back. Vengeance could be taken upon him and he could die, okay? So that's the picture, okay? Verse 8, this is David's response.
And the king said to the woman, go to your house and I will give orders concerning you.
What did David just say? Go away. I don't want to answer you right now. Why would David say, go away, I don't want to answer you right now?
He knows.
He knows, okay? What does he know, Pete?
He knows that what she's talking about, you know, applies to him because
right.
of what had happened.
He's in one of those situations where there's 4,000 people in a room and the pastor's teaching and going, is this guy talking to me right now? Like, quit looking at me, Brad. Like, this is awkward, right? Like, he is burning inside realizing, oh, gosh. If I make a judgment call on this as to what should happen in the situation, what am I saying? If I say, forgive the son, do not kill him. What is he saying? Absalom needs to be forgiven and not killed, right? So he realizes he's in a jam. So he basically tells her, go away. I don't want to deal with you. Okay. I don't even think it's, I'll get back to you in 24 hours. I'll let you know via email. It's go away. Okay. And she realizes, no, go away is not an option. So she, and this is good. She presses him gently, but she presses him. Jane, keep going to verse 9.
But the woman from Tekoa said to him, my lord the king, let the blame rest on me and on my father's family, and let the king and his throne be without guilt.
Okay, that basically in Hebrew says, make a decision. That's what she's saying. Be mad at me, but don't shuck and jive me again. Make a decision now. Okay, keep going.
She said, then let the king invoke the Lord his God to prevent the avenger of blood from adding to the destruction so that my son will not be destroyed. As surely as the Lord lives, he said, not one hair on your son's head will fall to the ground.
Okay, so David draws a line in the sand and he makes a decision from the king's mouth. What does he say? He will live. And if anybody has a problem with it, you send him to me. But not one hair on his head will be touched, okay? So David has just made a call. The son who is guilty will not be executed. He will be forgiven, okay? So from one man who killed another man, okay? Just like my son did, and she's going to basically say, yeah, I know the whole backstory, by the way, David. I know what you're thinking. I set all this up. You have to forgive your son, Absalom, okay? So that's part of what's going on, okay? Now, watch how she turns the table in verse 12.
Then the woman said, let your servant speak a word to my lord the king. Speak, he replied. The woman said, why then have you devised a thing like this against the people of God? When the king says this, does he not convict himself, for the king has not brought back his vanished son?
Ooh, that was a whack right in his face. I mean, I don't even know that she warmed it up. That was just a full-on backhanded slap in the face when she says, I know what you've done. You are convicting yourself and that you will not bring back your banished one, right? So David just now sees the rug get pulled out from underneath him and goes, oh gosh, she knows. And I've just made a statement saying the one who has killed another should be forgiven in the same way I should forgive Absalom, okay? Now, we see that picture, okay? Why, by the way, I think personally, there's a much deeper thing going on here than just these two stories, okay? Why, by the way, is David having such a hard time forgiving Absalom? What was Absalom's sin?
His sin.
His sin, which was what, Pete?
Not dealing with it in the beginning.
Okay? Give me more, okay? Absalom's sin is ultimately... And what did he do after he sinned with Bathsheba? He killed another man, okay? Now, not always, but I have seen repeatedly when someone cannot extend grace to another, okay? When they cannot offer genuine forgiveness. Jane, why is that?
Because they would have to do the same for themselves.
They've never assimilated it themselves. So when you see unforgiving, ungracious people, it's because they live in an unforgiving, ungracious world under an unforgiving, ungracious God. So in reality, what is this woman doing? She put David in the place of God to make a decision to say, I will forgive the son's actions. You see what she's doing? So what is David now having to assimilate with his whole relationship with God? I feel guilty. I did wrong. I have been living a lie for 2 years, for 3 years, I've been convicted, I confessed it, I wrote Psalm 51, like I'm past that, but what does he not feel from God? Forgiveness and grace, right? And she's saying, David, if you were in this situation as God, you were saying, I'm not going to execute justice. There are times when the right thing is to go above the law with the heart of God and forgive the son who has sinned. So he's just made a statement, ultimately, about how God views him. You with me? This woman is brilliant. Brilliant. I think the reason David ultimately won't deal with Absalom is because David hasn't dealt with himself. And he hasn't forgiven himself for his sin with Bathsheba, his sin with Uriah, and ultimately his sin against violating God. Okay? So she makes him forgive another so that he can see that through kind of his own eyes, if you will, all right? And it's a brilliant plan, okay? So I love this woman for that reason. Now, again, I think Joab set the table for this to happen, and this is why I'm like, gosh, I really like you, Joab, because this is exactly what David needed. He needed a kick in the pants theologically to get his head straight and to get back on track with God and realize, man, God is not angry at you. He has forgiven you. He loves you, and he wants to restore you, but you refuse to be restored, okay, because you won't feel the grace that's been offered to you, okay? So.
It's crazy how they use stories to, like, get his attention, like Nathan and then, you know. Like,
yeah.
Hey, you know, yeah, it's kind of.
Why do they do that, by the way? Why stories? Think about that.
Is it, like, separates them from the problem?
Yeah. Stories always take people off the defensive. it's asking questions, right? Nathan doesn't come in pointing fingers with guns blazing. He comes in and says, David, let me tell you a story. And he sucks him in and he draws him in and says, by the way, in the story, you're that guy. Your eye is that guy. The lamb is that girl, okay? And the traveler is your sin. So, and you go, oh, crud. You know, I got the hook in my mouth and I'm hook, line, and sinker into this thing and I can't do anything. So we had a seminary prophet used to say, I mean, we need more people with the shrewdness of Nathan to be able to be prophets, but to call out sin in a way that isn't like, you know, the people that, you know, that you see on the news, that you homosexuals and, you know, that scream from the college campuses and like, that is not what God wants in a prophet, obviously, right? But there's a right way to say, listen, this is truth, and we need to abide by it. And this is what our lives need to look like, measured up to God's word, okay? And that's what Nathan does. And this is what this gal does, right? And we don't even know her name, right? She's just a wise woman from Tekoa, okay? And is the hero of the story, okay? Verse 14, for we shall surely die and be like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. God does not take away life, but plans ways that the banished one may not be cast out from him. So that's her theology. God does not want to end his life. As you've said, he wants to find ways to restore relationships whenever possible. Okay, so that's how the story goes down. Okay. She kind of goes through the kind of the rest of her theology, reaffirms that. And kind of walks through that. Okay, so I think David's been literally walking in a season of just not grasping with forgiveness. He hasn't allowed himself to feel forgiven by God for, at this point, years in his relationship with God. Okay.
That's also why he didn't deal with Amnon.
I think it's exactly why. Okay. By the way, guys, what happens to a leader when you lose your moral authority to lead? This is where David's at. He slept with another woman that's not his wife. He's covered it up with a lie. And he murders a guy in order to do that. Now, he's confessed, he's whatever, but what's happened to David in the season? How is his leadership? It stinks. It's horrible. David, in all leaders, in a sense, us too, have to lead from a center of moral authority. We have to have the integrity to lead. And there's times as leaders, just like you and me, we sin, we struggle, we violate God's word, we do things that we know we shouldn't. But David has lost it to such a degree, he can't feel like he can be forgiven. So there's no way, if he can't forgive himself for this, how in his right mind can he judge others that have done the exact same thing that he has? So he just avoids it. Man, I can't deal with Absalom. I'm a murderer too, right? I can't deal with Amnon. Yeah, so he raped a girl. Oh, I slept with another man's wife and had him killed, right? How do I deal with that? You with me? Nehemiah is going to get put in a really sticky situation, and the center from which he's going to lead is from his moral authority. He's going to say, I have never done these things. I've never taken advantage of my brothers, by the way, as you guys have. I've never done this as you guys had. I had rights to do these things that would have hurt my people, and I didn't do them. And he steps up and basically just punks people. And because of that, the people that are raising a ruckus end up backing down because Nehemiah has not lost his moral authority, okay? So as leaders, there is nothing more important than that, okay? And there are times, moral authority does not mean you're going to walk with God perfectly without sin, but it means you blow it, you confess, okay? Maturity is not necessarily sinning less, which I think part of it is, but part of it is the distance between sin and confession in our lives needs to get shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. And we say, Lord, I cannot live in this funky, messed up relationship with you. I need to get right with you fast and deal with it, okay? So David was forced to sit on it for, you know, I don't know how long. Again, I reread that text the other day based on that question. It just said that the child dies. I don't know how old that child is, if he and Bathsheba's when it dies. Obviously young, but could it have been 2 or 3 years? Maybe. May have been 6 months. I don't know. But regardless, David walked in a season where he just didn't deal with him and God and didn't deal with the consequences of that, okay? So, all right. So enough on that, okay? So Absalom is still banished. This woman has now dropped some hard theology on David. He's having to assimilate it, whether he wants it or not. He's getting force-fed good theology. And at times, that's good for you. So shove it down your throat and like it, David, because that's exactly what you need, okay? Now, he's wise enough to realize in verse 19, he says to her, is this the hand of Joab? Like, was Joab behind this? And she says, yeah, like, I know you're smart. You figured it out, okay? So David's okay with that. But he basically realizes, man, this wasn't all just you, right? Joab was behind this. And again, this is why I'm so conflicted. What's in it for Joab to bring Absalom back? There's not really a selfish motive in that. He just realizes, David, this is the right thing to do. Okay, Joab's kind of a persister a little, right? On a bad day, he's bad. We're going to see in a couple chapters. On a good day, it's like, David, this is wrong, and you need to make it right, okay? And I'm going to punch you in the face until you make it right. And this is one of his good moments, okay? Verse 21, he says, I will surely do this thing. Go, therefore, bring the young man Absalom back. Now, David brings Absalom back, but he still hasn't quite gotten all this right. So he brings him in verse 24. Read that. 14:24. So he brings him back, but won't meet with him. So he won't. So he still hasn't fully assimilated the story. So he's in it, but he can't. He's having trouble living this out. Okay. So Absalom goes there. He cut the hair on his head. He kind of goes into mourning as well. Absalom, verse 28, now lives 2 full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face. So 5 years he's been banished from dad.
Didn't Absalom run away though? David didn't make him go away.
True. But I think he knew for good reason he was running away, or he would have been killed, which was the whole point of the woman's story. Like, man, if that kid's around, we're killing him. So Absalom knew, I need to get out of Dodge. It's not good for me here. So 2 years, Absalom says, wants to see his dad, right? By the way, there's some great father-son stuff in this text as well. Like, all he wants is to see his dad to give him a hug and say, I love you and I forgive you. And we can move on, okay? But there's going to be a point with Absalom where he says, you know what? Screw you. And that's what he does, okay? He says, you know, the heck with you, basically. 28, Absalom there is 2 years. 29, Absalom sent for Joab and said, hey, I'd really like to see dad. He sent for him a second time, but he would not come. So he's trying to go through Joab to get to dad. So he says, well, if you're not going to answer my emails, here's what I'm going to do, verse 30.
Then he said to his servants, look, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire. So Absalom's servant
Now, if there's a guy whose field you don't want to set on fire in Israel, I would put Joab like in my top three, right? I don't think you want to screw with Joab. And Joab arose, came to Absalom in his house and said, why have your servants set my house on fire? You know, he probably had a baseball bat in his hand as he's having this conversation. So like, hey, I'm trying to get your attention. And Joab, to his credit, doesn't fly off the handle. Okay. He says, I sent for you. You didn't come. Now, therefore, end of verse 32, let me see the king's face. That's all I want, is to see my dad. And if there's iniquity in me, then let me be put to death. Like, I can't live in this tweener world of, are you mad at me? Are you not mad at me? Am I forgiven? Am I half forgiven? There is no half, either you've invited me in and I'm in full fellowship with you, or I'm not. But this doesn't feel any different other than my physical proximity is closer, but I'm still not invited back into your life, dad. So like, this isn't helping him at all. So what's coming in chapter 15, again, is David's fault, okay? So when Joab came to the king, he said he called for Absalom. Finally, in verse 33, he came to the king, prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So they finally reunite at the end of verse 33, but for Absalom, it's too little, too late. And he says, you should have done this 2 years ago. I had to set Joab's field on fire for you even to take notice of me. I am not okay with this, okay? So chapter 15, here comes the coup in the kingdom. Absalom is going to revolt, and he is a shrewd guy. He's a handsome guy, and he is a bitter, jaded guy at this point, okay? Chapter 15, verse 1, let's pick up there.
After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him.
You guys remember about teaching on this with Gezer about the gates? Absalom is standing in the city gates with all the leadership, okay? And he's there where all the powerful people are, okay? This is a politician, okay? He is politicking right now. What city are you from? Where is your servant? What tribes are you from? Absalom would say in verse 3, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on part of the king. The king's too busy to hear your problems. But I'm here, verse 4, oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land, then every man who has a suit or a case would come to me and I would give you justice. This king, he doesn't have time for your petty problems. If I were king, I'd be in the trenches. I'd be with you. I'd be listening. You see what he's doing? He's winning people over at the city gates. Okay? Brilliant. Okay? So every time people came in with an issue, Absalom would come in and say, oh, let me help solve your problems, friend. Okay? End of verse 6. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. Okay? Right underneath David's nose, he has wooed everybody onto his team. Yeah, Callie.
Does everybody know about like all the stuff that David has done, like the sin of Bathsheba and then all the stuff with his sons?
That's a great question. We don't get a ton of insight as to how far spread that is. David and Bathsheba, I would think that's probably well known. There's certain people that certainly do. How far spread that is, I don't know. It's a good question.
Like,
okay.
I'm wondering if it was easy to walk their hearts away from David if they're kind of like done with him, like he just keeps doing all this stuff.
Potentially, yeah, it would certainly make it easier. Yeah, I don't know. So you notice in verse 7, my text is actually 40 years. It's a misprint. It's 4 years. So he stays in the gates for 4 years wooing the hearts of the people. Okay, Absalom does. And finally, he basically says, okay, the teeter-totter has turned. All the weight's on my side. I've got the hearts of the people. And he basically says, I'm going for the king. Okay? So he leads a coup. Absalom, in verse 10, sent spies all throughout Israel. He says, when you hear the song, the sound of the trumpet, you're going to rise up and say, Absalom, in verse 10, is king in Hebron. Okay? So here comes the coup. He grabs David's advisor, Ahithophel, in verse 12. Ahithophel, we're going to find out, is one of David's most trusted advisors. It says that in the end of chapter 16, that the advice of Ahithophel that he gave in those days was as if one inquired of the word of God. When you asked this guy for advice, it was like asking God for advice. Like, he's probably going to give you a pretty good answer, right? Ahithophel, by the way, is Bathsheba's grandfather. So Absalom leads a revolt and says, hey, why don't you come with me, Ahithophel? No longer with David. Why don't you come with me? And he says, okay. Why do you think Ahithophel would leave David and go with Absalom?
Because of what his granddaughter did.
Okay, so he's making some enemies in the kingdom, all right? So Absalom starts this revolt, chapter 13. The hearts of the men are now with Absalom. David realizes, what do I do now? I love my son. He's revolting. Okay, this can go one of two ways. I can muster up my men. He can muster up his. We can go to battle. I can kill my son. I can kill all my fellow countrymen that have now sided with him. Or I can just say, you know what? White flag. I'm going to leave. And David says, white flag. I surrender. I'm leaving. Okay? So David packs his camelback and his backpack, and he says, everybody who's with me, we're leaving town. Okay? We're going to leave. We'll let him have the throne. And this is pretty cool with David. David has always held the throne like this. When God is ready for me, he'll take Saul off it and he'll put me on it. If God wants Absalom to be king, so be it. I'm not going to fight for it. And David has always had a very healthy attitude about power. It's never gone to his head, so he won't grasp for it at all costs. Okay? David says in verse 14, arise, let us flee from one another. None of us shall escape from Absalom. So he realizes, man, this kid's going to fly off the handle and we're all going to die, or we're going to die trying. David definitely seems a little passive at times, right? Some days it feels passive. Other days he's going to feel very forgiving and magnanimous, where he's like, ah, I'll let that slide. So when he comes back, he's obviously going to come back on the throne. They're going to put this down. And there's a couple guys that he could execute justice on that he says, yeah, I'm not going to. And you read it and you go, I like that. So yes, it's hard to tell, right? It's like with Joab. I like you, but I hate you. I don't know how to feel about you. So you're a punk.
You might have said this earlier, but where is David's heart in all this, like, right now? Is he legit in the
husband? I think so. I think he's in a good spot. I think as good as he can be, given the fact that his son is rebelling against him. But I think he's assimilated forgiveness at this point. I think he understands. He's older. I mean, we're talking about a guy that's in his 60s at this point, maybe a little older. So he just leaves town, okay? He takes all these people with him. And I just want you to notice how the people respond to him. Verse 18, all his servants passed beside him. The Gittites, 600 men who were with him from Gath. So if you were from Gath, you were a Gittite, okay? Why would 600 people from Gath, where's Gath? Philistine city, okay, that David conquered, right? All these guys are now loyal to David, okay? 19, one of the Gittites, or Gattites, I guess that's why they call them Gittites, because Gattites sounds funny, named Ittai, okay, says, man, I'm going with you. And David says, no, stay here. He says, no, man, I'm loyal to you. I'm going with you. David says, man, 20, you just started hanging out with me like yesterday, not literally yesterday. He says, why would you risk this? It's much better for you to stay with Absalom. Just stay. Verse 21, Ittai says, as the Lord lives, my king lives, surely wherever my lord the king may be, whether for death or for life, there your servant will be also. Like, David has attracted some loyal people. And this guy says, look, I don't care if it costs me my life. Wherever you are, I am. Okay? By the way, it's May. We had taught this text at one point right before our youngest was going to be born. So you're reading through all the Old Testament. My kid was born in April. And anytime there was a guy's name, I'm like, ooh, Michelle, what about this? I'm like, I like Ittai. Like, what about Ittai? She's like, no. Like, May sounded really cool at 6:30 in the morning, but we're not naming our child Ittai. So thankfully she was a girl. She got a better name than Ittai the Gittai, but that was on my list. So I don't always make good decisions, but when I do, it's because of my wife. So there you go. All right. So Ittai the Gittai is one of those guys that are loyal. Okay. David leaves, by the way, verse 16, just to rewind the tapes a little bit, leaves all his concubines there, leaves his stuff. The priests are going to come out. This is fascinating. Verse 23, pick up there.
The whole countryside wept aloud as all the people passed by. The king also crossed the Kidron Valley, and all the people moved on toward the desert.
All right, now, you guys know geography. They passed over what valley?
Kidron.
The Kidron. What side of Jerusalem is the Kidron Valley on? East, okay? Down the Kidron Valley, what is up right on the other side of the Kidron? Mount of Olives and the Garden of Gethsemane. Okay, we're going to go to all those places. You're going to see it. If you keep going east out of Jerusalem, where do you go?
Jordan.
Okay, ultimately to the Jordan. But what's before that? We're in the Judah Mountains. Okay, what's east of the Judah Mountains? Wilderness, nothingness, desert. Okay. They're not going to the Shephelah to go hide, okay? They are not going to a happy place. This is misery, okay? So he's going to the same place where Jesus was going to be tempted a couple thousand years later, okay? Awful, hot, okay? Mine says wilderness. This says desert. Whoever just read said desert. That's a correct rendition, all right? Now, Zadok, the priest at the time, comes out with the Ark of God. David says, return, in verse 25, the Ark of God to the city, okay? Now, what would the Ark of God mean to David? Yeah, a lot. Yeah, you want to go into battle with the Ark of God? Like, yeah, I'd probably take it if I had to choose. David says, no, leave it here. Okay, listen to his rationale in verse 25. Callie, read that.
Then the king said to Zadok, carry the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see both it and his throne.
Like, wow. This is his throne. It's not mine. If God wants to show favor to me, then I'll get the Ark back. I'll get the... But I'm not going to fight for this. So he holds it open-handedly, okay?
How does one person...
It would have been Zadok and the Levites with him, so he was just the representative. So no, there would have been assumed other people there. Okay, so David goes over the Mount of Olives in verse 30, covers his head, walks barefoot. The people were in mourning with him. 31, Ahithophel. David finds out, man, he left me. Like, gosh, my best counselor. David has this other guy in verse 32 named Hushai the Archite. Okay, whose counsel was almost as good as Ahithophel's. He comes with David, and David says, I want you to stay. And he says, what the heck? And he says, no, I want you to stay. You're going to be a spy for me for Absalom. Okay? So Hushai has communicated his allegiance to David. David says, don't come with me. Stay in the kingdom, and I want you to advise Absalom poorly. Okay? Now, you got to go head-to-head with Ahithophel's advice, whose advice is like God's. So you're going to have to beat that, and you're going to have to convince Absalom that you're no longer on my team, but you're on his team. Okay, so you're going to be a plant, you're going to be a mole in the new kingdom. Okay, so David's thinking a little bit. Okay, so that's the idea. All right, 16 we've read, that's the Mephibosheth story. All right, and they're leaving town. David finds out that Mephibosheth doesn't go with him, and he says, great, Ziba, you can have all his stuff. Okay, now we're going to get down to the battle. Okay, Absalom is going to get advice from Ahithophel and these guys. Okay, Chapter 16, let's see. Absalom is going to ask first of all, why Hushai is there. And he says in verse 17, is your loyalty to your friend, why did you not go with your friend? Meaning, I know whose team you're on, Hushai. You should have gone with David. Why are you here? Hushai says, hey, listen, it's all about the throne. Whoever has the throne, that's where my loyalty is. And Absalom says, okay, that makes sense. Okay. And now he says to Absalom, Absalom now says to Ahithophel in verse 20, give your advice. What do we do from here? We've got the king, we've got Jerusalem. David and his men are fleeing. What should we do? Okay, 21. This is Ahithophel's advice.
Ahithophel answered, lie with your father's concubines, whom he left to take care of the palace. Then all Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench in your father's nostrils, and the hands of everyone with you will be strengthened.
All right, so let everybody know you're the new king in town. Go up on the roof, beat your chest, okay? Everyone will know what you're saying, okay?
Who's the spy?
Hushai, okay? Not this guy. Ahithophel's the grandfather of Bathsheba, who's like, the heck with David, okay? And he's giving great advice, okay? Furthermore, he says this, 17:1, okay? Please let me choose 20,000 men that I may arise and pursue David tonight. This is Ahithophel speaking, okay? Let me take 12,000 men with me. I want to pursue David now. I will strike down the king alone. I will bring him back in verse 3. We're going to be victorious. So let's get this thing while it's hot. Let's not let him rest. These guys are tired. They've been traveling all night. They're going to be exhausted. Let's send 12,000 people. Let's go put this thing down and let's crown you as king. If you're Ahithophel, that's pretty good advice, right? You got a bunch of men who are weary and tired. They didn't leave for warfare. They left in mourning. And you're going to get 12,000 guys that show up on your doorstep. David's dead. I mean, he is as good as dead, okay? Then Absalom says, now call Hushai. Verse 5, let me hear what you have to say. Now, what does Hushai realize? If Absalom takes Ahithophel's advice and sends 12,000 men, what's going to happen to David? He's dead. I mean, he is dead in the water, okay? And this thing is over. And he says in verse 7, this time the advice of Ahithophel has given is not good, okay? This would be the first time ever that Ahithophel had given bad advice. And he basically says, listen, okay? You know my father, verse 8. He's awesome. He's like a mighty man, like a bear, you know, that's been robbed of his cubs. He says, David's awesome. They've hidden themselves in caves, verse 9. If you come in and attack, they're ready for you. You're hosed. So he plays David up as some like 20-year-old warrior in the wilderness when he's a 7-year-old grandfather right now that's like just trying to get to food and water. He says, hey, they know you're coming. You're going to get attacked. You're going to get beaten down. In fact, verse 11, don't send Ahithophel. You need to go personally into battle. You need to take down the king. You need to beat your chest a little bit and say, if you're the guy, then prove it. You see what he's doing? This young man, Absalom, he's placating to his pride. He says, so let's do that. And then in verse 14, you can see Absalom says, man, I kind of like that. So maybe we should wait a day or two. Then we'll send in the army. Like, I'll put on my nice, you know, war dressings, and then I'll go into battle, and I'll take down my dad. And he says in verse 14, the counsel of Hushai is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. Okay, so David's plan works. He gets bought a couple days where the people can rest, find some place to sleep, hydrate, eat, okay? They send to David and say, listen, in verse 16, they're coming. Now, I bought you 48 hours, but man, they are coming, so you better be ready, okay? Verse 23, watch how Ahithophel handles this. This is the first time in human history his advice has not been taken. Like, buddy, like, wow, relax. You know, I don't mean to make fun of that, but it's like, dude, you took your counsel and your job pretty seriously. So when Absalom's not going to listen to you, you're like, well, then the heck with it, okay? Now, 24 and following, Absalom finds his guy. His name is Amasa. He is the new, he is his Joab, okay? So the commander of his army is Amasa. Joab is still commanding David's army, so Joab left with David. They go out to do battle, and David basically says in chapter 18, beginning of 18, he's going to say, listen, we're going to need to go to battle, but don't mess with my son. Yeah, Callie.
So Joab and Absalom are cousins?
Joab and Absalom. Is that right? Yes, correct. Correct. So they're family. Yes, because, yeah. Okay, so they're family somewhere. I forget how the tree works, but yes, I think it's cousins. Okay, David gets supported, by the way, from some people from at the end of verse chapter 17 from Lodabar. Okay, they come out in verse 28, bring David beds, basins, pottery, wheat, barley, flour, water. Why would people from Lodabar come support David? Who do we know from Lodabar? Mephibosheth. These guys are loyal to David because of the way that David treated Mephibosheth. They come out while David literally is in the desert and say, here's food, here's a cot, here's some water, refresh yourselves, a place to sleep, here's a tent. Neat story, okay? 18, David gets the guys together and says, okay, listen, we're about to go into battle, okay? Joab, Abishai, and my third leader is going to be Ittai the Gittite, the guy that said, man, I am loyal to you. They're going to be the commanders of these three raids. David, at the end of verse 2, says, I myself will surely go out with you into battle. Why would David say that at this point in his life? Now, remember, he's old, but he's saying, I'm going in the battle with you.
Because he didn't go, whatever.
Last time I didn't go to battle, I got myself in a heap of trouble. So I'm going to go ahead and fight with you, okay? So let's go. They say, End of verse 3, you are worth 10,000 of us. Thanks, David, but no, you're going to stay here. You are worth too much. You're too valuable to be put out there as a pawn, and you're kind of getting up there in years, and we'll see that here in a couple chapters, okay? Now listen, verse 5, he says, the king said to Joab, to Abishai and Gittai, and to Ittai the Gittite, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. What does that mean?
Don't kill him.
Who's standing there when he says this? Joab, Abishai, Ittai, okay? So the three generals know he's hands off. Take him, but don't kill him, okay? Long story short, David's men win this battle. It goes in their favor. They slaughter, unfortunately, in verse 7, 20,000 men of Absalom's. Okay, so he takes the battle to him. Verse 9, this is kind of funny. You remember Absalom is this really good-looking, long-haired, he's a little bit more like Saul, Fabio-looking dude, okay? He rolls on his donkey, on his mule rather, underneath a tree in verse 9. His mule went under thick branches of a great oak tree. He caught his head fast in the oak, and he was left hanging between heaven and earth, between the mule that was under him. The mule that was under him kept going. So he goes under a tree. He gets all of his hair caught in the tree. His mule keeps going, and now he's hanging there, legs swinging from a tree. He's like, oh, crud, right? So he's in a very odd spot, okay? So welcome to the, I guess that's why men shouldn't have long hair. I don't know what the moral of that story is, but he got himself in a pickle, okay? Joab rolls up, and when he comes up, he's like, oh, hey, Absalom, what's going on, dude? You're hanging from a tree. And one of Joab's guys is there, and he says to him, why, in verse 11, did you not strike him to the ground? And the guy says, did you not hear what David said? He said, don't kill him. And he says, shut up. In the Hebrew, verse 12, the guy basically says that, you know, even if I had been handsomely rewarded, I wouldn't touch him, because David clearly said, don't touch him. Joab says, I will not waste my time in verse 14 with you here. He took three spears in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. So he's hanging there. Joab doesn't take one spear, he takes three and just runs him through. Shish kebabs him right there. Kills him dead. I don't care what David said. He's leading a coup, he's going down. I mean, Joab's world is very black and white. You're a problem, we're going to fix problem. Problem solved. Okay, that's as simple as that for him. So he's probably not sure how. Yeah, there's not a lot of, like, they probably don't have tea together. Okay. They took his body, threw it in a heap, and said, we're done with that. Okay. The rest of chapter 18 is about two guys that basically now are running back to David to tell him, hey, the coup's been put down. Everyone's dead. And everyone thinks David's going to think this is great news. Like, hey, the coup's been put down. Everybody's dead. Okay. David asks in verse 32, is it well with the young man Absalom? Tell me about my son. I know we won the battle. What happened to Absalom? Okay. And this Cushite, one of the guys that had run back at the hand of Joab to report what had happened in the battle, said, let the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you be as that young man. What does that mean? We killed him dead. And anybody that rises up against you, that should be the same. Now, this guy thinks that would make David happy. And he realizes, no. That was wrong, okay? Verse 33, the king was deeply moved, went to the chamber over the gate and wept. And he walked around and said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son, my son Absalom, would I have died instead of you? Oh, Absalom, my son Absalom." So he is still just stricken with grief over his jacked up relationship with his son. Now he's dead and he realizes, gosh, I should be in your place. So he's just conflicted, okay? And now as a result of this, David is in chapter 19, kind of sunk into this funky depression and isn't leading. And Joab is going to be the one that has to pull him out and say, "Listen, you've got a country to lead, dude. You can't just sit here and cry over your son. Like, man, I'm sorry, but let's move on." Now, Joab's in a difficult spot. Not really, I suppose, because he realizes David's not going to touch me. I just killed his son. And like, what are you going to do? So David's in a weird spot, I suppose. But it, basically news gets to him and he says, "Man, David, you got to step up and lead." Okay. Verse 5, this is what Joab tells David. 19:5.
"Then Joab came into the house to which the king, to the king and said, 'You have today covered with shame the faces of all your servants who have this day saved your life and the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and your concubines, because you love those who hate you and hate those who love you.'"
You get what he's saying? All the people that were on your team, you're shaming them. You're hating those who love you, and you're loving those who hate you. What does that mean? Who are the love those that hate you? That's Absalom. That's what he's saying. Like, Absalom flipped you the bird and tried to take over your kingdom, and you're mourning because of him, and all these people who literally laid down your life for them, you're completely ignoring them. Joab's absolutely right. He's like, "Dude, this is wrong. Like, David, you cannot respond like this," okay? And he says at the very end, I mean, he's going to be very poignant, okay? Keep going. Middle of verse 6, "For I know this day that if Absalom were alive," I'll get it, "and all of us," I'm going to read it for you anyway, "for I know this day if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead, then you would be pleased." Like, wow. Had you lost everybody in the kingdom but your son lived, you'd be happier. You wouldn't be in here crying. I mean, that is a, boy, backhanded slap. I mean, he just tells him as he sees it, okay? "Now, therefore," he basically says, "get off your butt, get up and speak kindly to your servants and swear by the Lord. If you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you." He basically says, "You're going to lose everybody. David, you got to get up and lead now," okay? In 28, or verse 8 rather, he does, okay? David gets up, goes to the gate, says, "Behold, the king is still sitting in the gate. All the people came before the king. Now Israel had fled each to their tent." They didn't know what to do. So what do you do if you're Israel and you sided with Absalom and David just put down the coup? Are you welcome back in town? No, because David's going to think you picked the wrong team. So everybody's conflicted and David won't lead. David now is finally stepping up to the plate and says, "Okay, we need to reunite the kingdom. I need to be gracious. We need to bring everybody back." David now in verse 11, sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, and he says, "Speak to the elders of Judah." Okay, where's David from? Judah. And he says, "Absalom and Abiathar priests, go talk to the elders of Judah, and this is the message I want you to send them. Why are you the last to bring back the king and his house, since the word of Israel has come to the king, even into his house?" What is he saying to the elders of Judah? Why are you the last to bring back the king?
Why didn't you side with me?
First, why have you not restored me? I am your people, and you won't even publicly acknowledge that you're on my side. Okay, you are my brothers, you are my bone in flesh. Verse 12, why then should you be the last to bring back the king? Like, you don't know whose side to be on, and if anybody should be on my side, it's you guys. Okay, and then he says in verse 13, Amasa, Absalom's old general, you're my new general. I just fired Joab. Okay, so that's his one act of, like, David's trying. He doesn't ever actually deal with Joab, he just fires him, like, via email, right? Joab, you're done. Go sit on the bench. And now, Amasa, you're going to be my guy. Now, politically, smart move. You take Amasa's, Absalom's old general, and you bring him on your team. What is David saying? Hey, I trust him. He led the coup against me. I'm being gracious, okay? So I've forgiven all of you. So it's a political move to say, yeah, we're all good, okay? So he's now on my team. In fact, Joab, you're fired. Okay, so whether it's him actually dealing with Joab or him just trying to be politically savvy and reunite the kingdom, I think it's the latter. Okay, so that's the idea. All right. When David was, by the way, getting run out of town, there was a guy named, in verse 16, Shimei, or Shimei, however you say his name. And he basically, when David was leaving out of town, fleeing from Absalom, he basically walked around the ridge line between David and all his men and shouted profanity at him. Okay? Get out of here. Saul's coming back on the throne. His line's being restored. The heck with you. You know, like, mooning him. I don't know what he was doing. But he was a turd, okay? An absolute turd, and clearly showed what side he was on, okay? He comes back down in verse 18 and says, 19, 18, and falls down before David humbly and realizes, oh, man, I screwed up. I clearly picked the wrong team, and I, like, painted my face and had my banner that said, go Team Absalom, and now I'm on the wrong side, okay? He says, I have sinned. Abishai, verse 21, listen to what his response is. Abishai, again, Joab's kin, on David's side since day one. This is his suggestion.
Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered, shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed.
So he says, David, kill him. He cursed you, kill him. David says, you know what? No, 23, you shall not die. There's going to be no bloodshed in the kingdom today. Okay, he restores him. 24 and following, this is where he restores Mephibosheth. 31, there's a guy named Barzillai that's an old dude that went with David. He honors him with his son. He just honors everybody, okay? He has a neat... what does he say? Look at 19:22. David says... should any man be put to death in Israel today? For do I now know that I am king over Israel? God's restored my throne. I don't need vengeance. I don't need to kill these people because they punked me. I have my throne back. That's what God wanted. We're not going to kill people. So, he, again, that magnanimous personality David comes about where he had the right to execute judgment, or as a display of, hey, how dare you guys rebel against me? He could have killed these people. He doesn't. Okay, so he restores all through chapter 19 some pretty cool guys. Okay, so that's chapter 19. 20... a second coup comes, okay? This is, David's going to deal with this one very different, okay? A worthless fellow, 20 verse 1, named Sheba, who is a Benjamite, okay? Why a Benjamite rising to the throne? Saul, okay? They're trying to take the throne. All the men of Israel withdrew from following David, verse 2, and followed Sheba. Never follow a guy by the name of Sheba, by the way. I mean, they should have known better, right? And all the men of Judah remained steadfast to David. So now we've got a second split in the kingdom. And David realizes, man, we can't keep doing this, right? We need to put this thing down, and we need to put it down good, okay? So he brings out his new general, Amasa, and says, hey, Amasa, rally the troops. We need to go to battle. Amasa, I don't know, was like playing Nintendo and forgot and took too long, and verse 5 delayed. So David now goes to Abishai and says, dude, like, can somebody please get the troops together? So Amasa doesn't. Abishai does. Abishai calls his brother Joab and says, hey, dude, you want to go to battle? We're going to battle today. Let's go. And Joab's like, awesome, let's go. They go out to battle, and Joab is a little bit ticked, so he finds Amasa, who just took his job, and in verse 9 says, hey, dude, is it good with you? Is it well? Like, how are you? Let's talk, right? Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand and kissed him. You know what's coming next. Verse 10, Amasa was not on guard against the sword which was in Joab's hand, and he struck him in the belly, and it poured out his inner parts on the ground. He did not strike him again, and he died. Okay? Joab's got to have a bit of history with this. So, you know, anybody named Joab ever wants to give you a hug, just say, you know what, no, let's just high five. You know what, better yet, like, let's just, yeah, let's wave from a distance, okay? No touching, okay? So he kills Amasa. He literally leaves him bleeding in the middle of the road and then says, okay, everybody follow me. I'm the new general. And everyone's like, dude, you just gutted this guy. Like, there's his colon. Like, and he's like, okay. Literally, they won't follow him. Okay. Verse 12. Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the middle of the highway. Like, he's not even dead. He just guts him and is like, you'll die eventually. Everybody else, come with me. Like, he doesn't even end. I mean, Joab's just dirty, and everybody's like, panicked. And finally, Joab's just great. Then I'll kill him so you guys can be done being panicked and then follow me. That's what he does. He's just. Joab's weird. Kills him, moves him to the side of the road, and everybody's like, okay, then now we can follow you. So that's what happens in 13 and following. They go after him. They basically chase the boy named Sue, Sheba, that is trying to lead this rebellion into this house. Here's another story of a great woman, okay? they chase him into this city, right, with walls around it. Joab basically starts saying, okay, guys, destroy the whole city. Whole thing. Tear it down because we're going to get to him. And this wise woman calls to Joab from up on the ledge and says, dude, what are you doing? Like, there's other people that live here. Quit jacking with us. What is it that you want? Why are you destroying our wall and ultimately our city? And Joab's like, oh, well, 19, he says in 20, far be it. I just want this dude. And bring him to me. Guy's name is Sheba. Hand him over, and we'll leave you alone in verse 21. Okay? And she says at the end of verse 21, behold, his head will be thrown to you over the wall. Deal. You'll quit screwing with our city if we just give you him? And he says, yeah, that's all I'm here for. The woman wisely came to the people, verse 22, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it at Joab. Did you get it? Yeah, got it. Okay. Like, leave his body there if they just toss his head over the wall. Like, note to self, don't lead a coup against David, okay?
Did Joab fall in love with that girl?
I don't know. Like, you got to think he'd like her. Like, wow. That reminds me of a funny story that I won't tell you. So, sorry. I came home yesterday. My wife is using power tools. And I was like, wow. She's in the garage with a circular saw. And I'm like, I'm a little nervous, but that's, I kind of am attracted to you right now. That's kind of awesome. So, yeah. My wife has a history with knives in her hand and can't quite figure out that they aren't supposed to touch each other. So she's out there alone with the power saw. And I'm like, oh, babe, what are you doing? Oh, gosh. This could end badly. So, anyway. So, it's my kind of woman, too. Cut off his head. 21. Now we're going to see a whole different side of the story. 20, the famine is put down. Or the famine's put down. Famine's coming. The coup is put down. 21, there's a famine coming. Sorry, I'm trying to get us through here. I got a minute and a half to cover like five chapters. So, okay. Okay. 21, God brings a famine on the land, right? What is famine normally a sign of? Yeah, sin. And God basically tells David, here's why I'm doing it, okay? End of verse 1, God says, it is for Saul and his bloody house, for he put the Gibeonites to death. Apparently, you guys remember the group of people that Joshua made the agreement with? They came in the land, faked like they were really far away, put in old wineskins, and said, hey, we're all on the same team here. And Joshua says, okay, we won't kill you. And then they found out like 3 days later, oh, wait a second, you're our next door neighbors, lying dogs. Well, Saul slaughters them all, or tries to, okay, knowing that Joshua had made a pact with them. So they come back, and God brings now a famine during David's day because of what Saul did. David says to the Gibeonites, dude, verse 3, what do you want? And they said, we don't want silver or gold. Line up for all of us, Saul's relatives, and we want to kill them all. Give us 7 of Saul's kin, and we'll kill them all. Now, what's the problem for David? He's made a pact, okay, with who? Jonathan, regarding specifically Mephibosheth, okay? So he does this, but in verse 7, the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the oath that he had sworn. So he's stuck, but he gives them 7 other sons. These sons get murdered in broad daylight by the Gibeonites because of their, because of Saul's sin, but he keeps Mephibosheth, which tells me, how does David ultimately view Mephibosheth? As a son and truly loyal. So he sees his repentance when he come back in town and says, great, I don't want any of your stuff anyway. So you see kind of the cool rest of the story of, I think, how David says, you know what? Yeah, you know what? You're the real deal. Okay. So long story short, these men die. David now is going to finally get the bones of Jonathan and the bones of Saul from the men of Jabesh Gilead. You guys remember that those guys came in, pulled Saul and Jonathan off the wall because they were in Beth Shean. They were getting dishonored. Bring them back to their town. David says, I want those bones back. And he buries Saul and Jonathan in their dad's tomb in Benjamin, in Kish's tomb. Okay. At the end of verse 14, it says, God was moved by prayer for the land. So David, even though this is a horrible story, acts rightly. Does good, and God is moved and begins to release the famine and blesses the kingdom once again. All right? Now, we'll finish the rest of the chapters next week. We'll boogie through the next deals up into next week. How about tomorrow? Just take it. We got plenty of time. We don't even need tomorrow. So we'll pick up in 1 Kings tomorrow, finish 2 Samuel as well. All right? You guys have a great day. We'll see you bright and early in the morning.